Can you describe where you're calling from?
Do you mean in the larger sense or in the sense of the tiny closet where I'm sitting?
Both, actually.
All right. I am calling from Stehekin, Washington, which is a very small town at the north end of Lake Chelan, accessible only by ferry this time of year. So if you took the ferry to Stehekin, you would get in a car that's been barged up here, and you drive 6 miles up a road that's paved at first and then turns to dirt. And then you would arrive at the home that my wife Lori and I built 20 years ago. And I'm upstairs in that cabin in a tiny closet with mostly work clothes. So wool shirts and canvas work clothes and boxes full of books.
Hello and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast featuring authors from the Western United States. Our funding comes from Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio. I'm Sarah Aronson, speaking with Anna Maria Spagna about Uplake, Restless Essays of Coming and Going. Stay with us. How has this lockdown been for you two?
This has been remarkably not dissimilar from regular life. You know, we can go outside. We don't see, I mean, it wasn't uncommon for me before to go several days, even a week, without seeing another human being besides Lori or spending extensive time with another human being besides Lori. So in that sense, it's, you know, it's like normal life. And yet the news from the outside world affects us, of course, emotionally and makes everything seem somber, even when it's the most glorious time of year here in a lot of ways. So it's a little dissonance.
Absolutely. I can't wait to talk a little bit more towards the end about, oh, you know, what it means to live in kind of a remote place, especially during a global crisis. But let's start at the beginning. This is a collection of restless essays of coming and going, and you make the point in your prologue that your story is not like the hero's journey in that it's a story of return. It's a story of, you know, a girl who leaves the sunny suburbs of LA, moves to the woods, and essentially stays gone. And I want to know, in what ways has that path offered you returns or rewards?
Oh, in so many ways. I mean, I think that one purpose I had in mind, as much as you have a purpose, I mean, I don't want to act like I came to the woods intentionally. I came here for a job. I fell in love, the way life unfolds for anyone. But once I was here and thinking about it, and especially writing about it, I just was, it's so important to me, the things you learn and the way you experience a place when you see it so closely day after day after day. And especially the years I worked on trail crews, to know, you know, the particular rock at 5 Mile under which a rattlesnake lives, and you check for the rattlesnake every single time. There's just a real kind of intimacy with place that I think, you know, that comes with that long association and that close association with a place. And I don't think it has to be a remote place for this to happen. I think people who live in cities have the same kind of relationships over time. But for me, the outdoor part, the nature part, is part of my own nature and adds to my affection and my closeness with the place, the chance to know those rocks, those trees. My wife, Lori, maintains a historic apple orchard, and so for her, it is those 400 apple trees. I mean, she remembers, you know, when she planted it, when she grafted it, how it was pruned 2 years ago, what the winter damage was, and that just creates this this closeness, this relationship, really, with the place where you are.
That intimacy of the language of the land. And I guess I'm really curious about this sense of moving to a rural place and continuing to live with a sense of restlessness. That's one of the things I appreciated most about the book, is it's not like this quaint, predictable, you know, collection about, like, aren't the woods great? There's a lot of tension about the modern world, for instance, and about what it means to commit to a place and also have desires beyond that place. How do you reconcile that tension.
I don't think it can be reconciled. I think that's sort of the gist of the book and the gist of my experience. And yeah, definitely wanting to kind of poke some holes in that myth of serenity in nature, that that being apart from humanity is always peaceful. I mean, I long for the city in ways that aren't predictable. Like a couple years ago, I had the opportunity to live in Walla Walla, Washington. I taught at Whitman College for a year. And the things that delighted me about being in a place like that were like my daily encounters with the coffee vendor, you know, and who would give me a refill for 50 cents. That just delighted me. Or the bored lifeguards at the pool when I went swimming in the morning. And when you're in a place like this, you might have close friends, or, you know, I can be in touch with my family and maintain those ties, but you don't have as many of those kind of bumping into people, being part of a flock or a herd, maybe, right, that you have when you're out in the world. And I miss that. I miss it terribly. And I feel invigorated by those when I get the chance to be back in the world. But that's sort of when you're there. I think that in Uplake, what I'm more wrestling with are what you described, like the longing when I'm here, the missing of things, and you know, feeling unconnected, which is part of maybe the pathos of right now as well, that there's so much pain and suffering in the world that is both part and not part of our experience. You know, there's just a like a thread that ties you to humanity and to the rest of the modern world, that's always tugging a little bit, just tugging at me.
Right. It's interesting because on the cover of Uplake, you know, is a plane flying, you know, a very tiny plane flying across blue skies with trees in view, and there's this contrail. And I was thinking, like, why that image?
Oh, I actually requested that image, which hasn't always happened with my books, but I requested that image because that's the feeling that captures the feeling, I think, that you can still see the trees. You can tell that the perspective is from in the forest, but looking up at this opportunity to be going someplace else, that trajectory toward newness or toward awayness or toward humanity or toward it's just that looking at it and wondering. And I guess, I don't know, I feel like most people do that to an extent. You look at a plane in the sky and think, oh, I wonder where that's going. And what it would like to be aboard. And maybe that's the overall feeling of this particular book.
Yes, I totally agree. And I think what is so striking about it is during this time where so many flights are grounded and I can't even fathom when my next flight will be, to remember the time when airports were like something to look forward to or exciting. And in your essay, Flight Delay, you actually write, I am lonelier in the air than I am anywhere, and I often cry still. And I was hoping that you could speak a little bit more about what is it about air travel that unhinges us.
Yeah, I thought it was so strange to me that that flying became such a big part of writing these essays. I was a very frightened flyer, a terrified flyer for many, many years, and avoided it at all costs. And then my life has accelerated in such a way. I teach in different places, and I'm actually on planes often. And I feel like what's left of that terror, I'm not terrified anymore, but what's left of it is just that incredible sense of being torn away from the land as the plane takes off.
Yes.
Like I belong down there. I feel like I'm being ripped from where I belong, you know, and I feel wildly liberated and excited and yet like almost a sense of grief. That might be overstating it, but almost a sense of like I'm not part of what I need to be part of. But part of it is also the perspective of seeing the land in such a large scale instead of from the small scale. It's no longer the rock with the rattlesnake under it, but it's like whole mountain ranges, and to see the shapes of them and the beauty of that. Isn't that a crazy privilege that we have to be able to see it that way and to I don't know. It feels like that I'm lonely for it. And I also am almost in awe of the beauty and the bigness of it at once.
Yeah. I think you've named it. I want to talk about two other modern conventions in this book. The first being the internet, which is where the book starts. And in fact, the internet becomes a character, I think, in the book itself. And I was wondering, why do you think that is? Because oftentimes I refer to landscape as characters and other like novelists' work. But in yours, I was like, oh, okay, the modem, like the actual computer, the internet is like, has a role here.
Yeah. Well, I would have had more trouble articulating the answer to that question before this time when other people are now experiencing life the way I do.
Yes.
Which is that, like I said, I'm alone all day. I'm alone all day. And so my portal to humanity, to the rest of the world, is the internet, right?
Yeah.
And so it's this sort of, it's something that facilitates it and then also gets in the way. You know, I had... the essay Slow Connection is about my very slow connection that would be so frustrating when I'm trying to connect and I'm trying to learn and I'm trying to be part of this bigger whole. And there's like this, you know, roadblock between me and that. And so it's something that I interact with every single day, many hours of the day, and that I rely on so heavily and get frustrated with, that it is very much like a relationship. I love how you phrase that, Sarah. I hadn't thought of it that way, but it's absolutely true.
And I just want the listeners to know that you have done trail work for how many years?
I don't do it anymore. I did it for 15 years and all in the North Cascades. So, and mostly in the same Stehekin district. So the same 200 and 250 miles of trail. And then it has been quite a while since I gave it up. And so it's been a pretty radical change of lifestyle to go from camping in the woods, living in the woods, carrying a chainsaw for a living, to sitting in front of that computer screen for much of my day, and or going on an airplane to Los Angeles, where I teach in an MFA program. So I'm there for 10 days twice a year, staying in a Marriott that overlooks the 405 freeway. So there couldn't be a greater contrast between my trail crew life and my current life. Well, there could be a greater one, but it's a pretty, pretty big contrast.
And I am dying to talk about trail work, but I feel like it's my responsibility to ask you, how did that transition from doing physical labor to being a writer and a teacher happen for you?
It happened. I had been writing the whole time in my off seasons when I worked on Trail Crew. You know, I hadn't lost that passion, or I continued to the practice of it. And after my first book came out, then opportunity and two things happened. The book came out, and internet came to Stehekin. It came very, very late to Stehekin. The early aughts is when it arrived, and people asked me to teach online, which was something I had never done or considered, but it gave me a way to still live here and not have to do trail work. And, you know, I was 38 years old. My body was starting to break down a little bit. I wasn't as strong as I'd been at 23. And I was excited. I was excited to be able to kind of, you know, become someone new. And so it was heartbreaking to give it up. And there are still days when I ache to be working on the trails, which is so, so different than just walking on them or yes, having a vacation on them. That kind of life, that kind of physicality, that kind of closeness with your coworkers, that kind of pride that you take in accomplishment, I miss it. But the things that I learned on Trail Crew are absolutely the things that have translated to being a writer. There's a certain kind, like you can't have writer's block on Trail Crew. You can't have trail block. You can't leave a log half cut out of a trail. You just can't, right? And so, so I can, to a certain extent, approach writing with a more of a just get it done kind of, you know, put your head down and work perspective that I learned from Trail Crew. But the transition was radical and sad and exciting, and still I'm not quite over it. For for at least 5 years after I finished working trails, when people asked me what I did for a living, I would say, I used to work trails. That was my answer.
Yeah.
And it's still kind of one of the answers I want to give. it's such a strong part of my identity. And yet, this many years on, it starts feeling a little like maybe visiting your high school when you're in your late 20s. Like, you can't go back and
right.
relive the glory days. You have to let go of that at some point, you know.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to a conversation with Anna Maria Spagna about her collection of essays titled Up Lake. I'm Sarah Aronson. This is The Right Question. Our full conversation can be found online at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook. In the essay More Than Noise, you catalog your relationship with a chainsaw, and you make note that you never wore a hard hat, safety glasses, or even chaps. And I was hoping that you would speak about what it meant to be a female wielding a chainsaw.
No organization I worked for would be happy that I put that in print. I'm certain that I was supposed to be wearing safety gear when I used that. It was very empowering to run a chainsaw as a woman. And even saying that is kind of going against a certain code of trail crew where you never speak to the difference. You know,
yes.
You just do your job and take pride in it. But It's the kind of thing that for some reason we just assume that that's a job for a man, and to pick it up and to become, you know, proficient or even excellent at using it just gives you this sense of, I don't know, of possibility in life. I mean, this sounds crazy, but only because I've run a chainsaw would I ever consider that, yeah, I could probably, you know, go in a rocket ship, or I could probably try to figure out how to take apart an engine and put it back together, even though I'm the least mechanical person in the world. But it's just that it's something I never thought I could have done for reasons that are probably just cultural, and then was able to master. And what a great feeling that is. And there must be so many things in life that women in particular we think we can't do, even without knowing we think we can't do them.
Right.
And then to do them is empowering, I guess, is the word.
Anna Maria, I want to pivot over to the essay that you've titled Post-Strayed, in which you tackle both the through hikers on the Pacific Crest Trail who pass through your town, as well as Cheryl Strayed and your relationship to her work and her as a writer. And I was actually just hoping that you would start by reading the first couple pages.
All right. I guess what I would like to say about this essay, since we're only getting the beginning of it, is that it really does have a hinge in the middle where I come clean about not only my respect, but my intense admiration for Cheryl Strayed's work and also for the ambition of through hikers. So despite the fact that it begins with some disparagement, there is some change and some nuance in my perspective within the essay. And with that, I'll begin. Post-Strayed. Each summer, while we moved heavy rocks or sawed suspended logs or cleared head-high stinging nettles, Pacific Crest through hikers, those heading to Canada from Mexico, sped past us. They needed to keep moving because they were so close to the end. Only 80 miles shy of the border, they were in some ways sick of it all. And because they usually wore shorts despite thick swarms of biting black flies. Those of us who had to actually work to stand amid the onslaught kept every inch of skin clothed. Back in town, after work, we'd run into the thru-hikers, scruffy and unshowered, in the post office as they collected their resupply boxes they'd sent ahead to themselves. Many were hiking alone, so they were desperate to talk to someone, to anyone, and you could get stuck for way too long if you weren't careful. Some neighbors griped about that, or about the body odor stench, but neither the chatter nor the smell bugged me much. The attitude did. They acted proud, exceedingly so, and entitled to the random kindnesses bestowed on them over months on the trail, the gifts from trail angels, food, rides, a bed or a shower, sometimes cash. The hikers gushed dreamily about the miracle of it all, like ticket-grubbing stoners outside Grateful Dead concerts. Over beer, around a campfire, we sneered freely. How privileged were these modern-day pilgrims with quadriceps thick as hams who prattled on and on, frantic and breathless? Who could afford to take an entire summer off to walk? The truth was, any of us could. We were used to frugality, but wouldn't allow ourselves the frivolity. We believed in hard work and in loyalty to one place. I sometimes joked that when thru-hikers bragged about hiking 2,500 miles, we should say we'd hiked just as many PCT miles, but all on the same 15-mile stretch, one on which we knew every marshy bog, every sun-scorched switchback, every patch of boxwood or wild cherry. We knew where to find the long-stashed rock bars, usable outhouses, peak of views of peaks, where you were likely to encounter a bear or a porcupine. We knew the trail, as they say, like the backs of our hands or our hard, callous palms.
In thinking about what it means to, you know, to love a place and to live in a place and in some ways to defend a place with these thru-hikers, I'm just really curious about, you know, you had come to these particular woods from the LA suburbs. What do you know about your interiority that chose this landscape? I mean, I hear the parts about, you know, you found a job and there was love involved and, you know, life unfolds the way it does. But just what was it about that landscape that really spoke to you?
I think there's no overstating the beauty of the place. I mean, the wholeness of the trees and the green and the river and these mountains that go from, you know, snow-capped to rushing cascades of water to, you know, to yellow and red and orange and all the colors of fall. The beauty is stunning. Having that when you've come from the desert and you've come from a place that, you know, is crisscrossed with freeways and so much asphalt, it was like coming into Oz, honestly. It was like waking up in a whole new world of possibility and of comfort and of just life, you know. And I still wake up sometimes and think, How can this be? And it also, I think, informed. I mean, I can't imagine that I would have the same passion for the place. I would have a different kind of love if I hadn't grown up in L.A., if I hadn't seen what happens to a place, you know, when it's developed to such an extent that it's hard to find trees and water and that kind of respite, even in a desert environment. And so I knew from the beginning, from when I first showed up in this place, and even when I just first showed up in the Pacific Northwest, that I would value it in a special way because of where I had come from.
Right. And going back to the point of, you know, of outsiders and people maybe misunderstanding why you live there or even seeking it out, I've been really thinking about what it means to be in a remote place during the time of COVID, especially knowing that Seattle was one of the first epicenters in the United States. Did you have to negotiate any of that in terms of people seeking refuge where you live?
That hasn't happened so much yet. I suspect that it will more as people with second homes and or people just looking to escape end up here. I know that's happened other places. Sun Valley or Gunnison, Colorado have been tragically hit by it. And I have to admit, I've had some feelings of worry about that. Because you can only get here on the ferry, you know, it's a funnel. People are all going to be together for that 2.5 hour time frame. And so that's a space where the virus could be spread. And it makes me feel vulnerable. I had an apartment in Missoula because I had been teaching there in the spring. And I seriously considered going there instead because it would be closer to medical care. And it, in some ways, it would be safer from, you know, people kind of spreading the virus in that particularly close contact way of the boat. And it's sort of the same thinking that we have when people say, oh, you're set, you have everything. Well, we depend on the boat to bring our groceries. As soon as that boat stops running,
yes,
we're isolated in a way that that you and Missoula are not. And so, again, it's that the certain tension of the myth of how idyllic it is and how wonderful and safe it is from the truth that actually, no, we do have, you know, we have connections that are tenuous and sometimes dangerous, in this case, to the outside world. So that's some of my thinking. I also am aware and worried about how much the virus makes us fear, you know, fear others, fear strangers, or even friends, our dear, dear friends who have second homes, who want to come here, and to have the feeling of, oh, no, I don't want them to come because I don't want to get sick is a terrible feeling to have, instead of course, I want them to be able to come here where they'll feel safe, where they can be close to nature. To to have that tension within myself is troubling.
Anna Maria, I want us to maybe move back into a space of love and desire. What do you desire these days?
Oh, that's such a sweet question, Sarah. Thank you. I think that I desire to be part of a community that is a little bit larger than this, to be part of, you know, I was thinking about it in terms of the robins that come. I was watching the robins. They must do this everywhere. They come in this funny little flock. It's not majestic at all. They come kind of haphazard and land like poorly trained paratroopers and run around the yard and peck at a few maple leaves. You know, they don't seem terribly purposeful about the whole thing, but they seem quite gleeful to be together and to be doing their thing. And they're just going to check out what's there. And then one of them's going to decide to fly off and they're all going to fly off together. And that's a little bit how it feels to me to be in a place like Missoula or Walla Walla or you know, a city that way, a small city or town. And whether it's long term or short term, I have this craving within myself to be part of what those sort of makeshift flocks, you know, going about the everyday life. And all my life, I've had this drive to be solitary and to be purposeful. And I have this lighthearted feeling of letting go of a little of that. I don't have to be either if I don't want to be.
Anna Maria Spagna lives in Stehekin, Washington. She's the author of 7 books and was the Kittredge Distinguished Writer in Residence in Environmental Studies at the University of Montana during the spring 2020 semester. Look for more information about her and her work at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting us since 2008, and thanks to you for listening. I'm Sarah Aronson, and this has been The Right Question.
The Right Question is produced by Sarah Aronson, Beth Ann Austin, studio engineer. The music in this program was written and performed by John Floridis. You'll find links to our podcast and Facebook page at mtpr.org.